Hello everyone, Bruce Edwin here with HollywoodSentinel.com, and we're speaking here today with Nomi Prince. Nomi, how are you?
I'm great, Bruce. Thank you for having me on.
Excellent, pleasure. And listeners, for those of you that are new to Nomi's work, where do I begin? She is just, when I first heard about Nomi, Nomi, I'll tell you as well, I was so intrigued by you and what you do. She's an American author. She's a journalist. She's been published in the New York Times, in The Nation. She was a former senior managing director at Bear Stearns. Nomi, if I'm not mistaken, correct me, for 7 years, senior strategist at Lehman Brothers, analyst at Chase Manhattan Bank, and a globally published author, author of all the President's Bankers, author of It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street, and of course, her latest book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Nomi, thanks for all you're doing, and thanks again for being here. Wow, what a resume.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So now I've read your, and I tell this to anyone I tell about you, I brag about how smart you are. And I say that working in Hollywood. I mean, there are smart people in Hollywood. I won't discredit everyone here. But, you know, you've got, I read a master's degree in science statistics, if I'm not mistaken. Also a bachelor's in math from SUNY. You worked at, rather your family member father worked at IBM. How did you start all this? Tell us a bit about your beginning and where you're from and how you started in this world of banking.
Well, that's like an interesting question because, you know, you mentioned my dad, which a lot of people don't, and I thank you for that. My dad is a statistician. He worked at IBM, like, back in the day when it was developing all sorts of new things, and now, of course, there's lots of other companies that do some of what it does. But he worked at a research institute called the Watson Center in Briarcliff Manor, New York, and that was very close to where I did my math degree at SUNY Purchase.
Tell us the name of where, what was the name again, please?
So it's called the Watson Center, and that was basically the think tank. It's where they, it was basically like the Google part of IBM, where they would get all the like math scientists together, and they would basically let them do whatever they wanted to do, or like create things and think. And it was very interesting because IBM was very corporate, but it had this very cool atmosphere. It was very near where I went to school, and I was, you know, just like to hang out there with my dad, and there was a mathematician there. His name was Benoit Mandelbrot, who was the father of something called fractal mathematics. And what fractal mathematics were, you know, this is not the topic that was, you know, at hand in my book, but just because you asked, it's a science of chaos. It's basically how to look at patterns and to figure out how things could perform or might perform, but also keep an eye on the fact that things can change. That it, you know, no one model really explains everything. Things can change as you go along your way. And so one of the things that I always learned as a mathematician from my dad is that, you know, math equations work, numbers have truth to them, but, you know, we're all people in a world, and certain things can have external factors bear on them. And that was just something that I kept very early on. And so when I graduated from SUNY and I moved to New York City and I got a job at Chase, I got a job as a programmer, and I basically started modeling the most chaotic parts of finance, which were things called options, from the get-go, when they just became, you know, a new presence in finance, a way to sort of create bigger bets, if you will, on different things that were going on in different markets. And
yes,
that's basically my career, was always on that complex side of finance from that point on. As I went international, as you mentioned, at Bear and so forth. So that's kind of how that all started.
Well, very interesting.
I don't get a sense for that truth of math and change at the same time.
And pardon me, what's the last part?
And I always kind of kept that sense of truth that both math and change and just sort of the human.
Sure.
At the same time.
Well, that's fascinating. There's so many things going through my mind I want to ask you now. And regarding the, we'll have to get the spelling on the title of that school your father went to later. For some reason, that part's not being made clear, but we're hearing you pretty well otherwise. Very fascinating. So I guess, Nomi, one thought racing through my mind, just came to my mind, rather, about a lot of what you said. I interviewed a while back, not to digress, Noam Chomsky. And Noam, of course, I'm sure you're well read on, is not only political theorist, but also professor of linguistics. And what I had asked Noam was, I was asking him about the construction of language and just how the human creation, literal creation of a language, can control a person's thought or ideology and such. And I guess I want to ask you the same thing about math, because I never really thought about that much until it popped into my mind now. How is the construction of math and how math is practiced and taught today, how does that control, let's say, human behavior or economics?
I think math in and of itself, the structure of it, the theories of it, whether you're studying calculus, which is to a small extent, I mean, it's less complex than sort of options pricing, but there's a lot of math that goes into the description of how economics and how finance evolved over a small period of time, over a bigger period of time, and so forth. The science of economics, I call it science, it's also an art. It really depends what you're talking about. Huh. But the numerical part of economics and how, you know, growth is explained, or even how weight is changing is explained, is kind of very basic math. Whereas the math of finance, and options and complex securities tend to be using more complex economics, mathematics. And so there's structures in both of them that pertain to math in different elements of, you know, just simple and more complicated methods. But I also think what's important, and maybe this is something Noam touched on, I still admire the fact that he can do, you know, what he does next to a singlet, but in other words, he encompasses different areas.
Right.
Is that there's a human element. You know, you take math or you take economic statistics, economic data, and different people can interpret it in different ways based upon their ideologies, based upon how they use it, based upon why they're using it.
Yes.
And what I always try to do in my work is, to the extent I can, because I probably have my own filters as well, but I know about them, it's try to look at things in a pure sense and look at different statistics and different data to come up with, a theory or just a statement about something that's happening in our environment, either historically or now, or just predicting in the future, because things do change, and we are people, and there is an element of how you use numbers in fact, in order to make your argument.
Interesting. And based on that statement, and based on your assessment of the aspect of economics or those aspects of mathematics being potentially arbitrary based on one's viewpoint or how they practice it, what do you think is the dominant world element now of how mathematics is practiced, if you could ascribe, let's say, an ideology or philosophy to it?
Well, I think that on the one hand, there's very theoretical mathematics, which is kind of divorced from how people use it in terms of explaining, you know, the economy or banking or anything like that. But I think in general, I think math isn't understood as much in a lot of these disciplines and even in how we interpret the world. And I think that if more people had a better grasp of some more basic practical applications of math, I think they would also have a better grasp on how the economy works and how people who are in charge of different aspects of the economy make decisions and how those decisions impact them and so forth. So I think math hasn't really had its it's not as understood as it could be. I think it could be more prevalently used and understood, and I think that would help people also have a better comprehension of sort of their finances and the world around them.
Well, that makes sense, and I'm sure. So to kind of clarify what you're saying, do you feel, I know with your book, and I want to heavily get into that in a minute here, with collusion, how central bankers rig the world, you are suggesting, and I wouldn't even just say suggesting, but I would say you are essentially proving how these individuals, a certain elite group of individuals in the global monetary system, have basically devised this, the financial structure of America and other top leading economies to make the market benefit themselves and really just essentially trick or confuse the populace. Is that pretty true?
Well, yeah, from the basis of what happened since the financial crisis, which is now 10 years ago, technically began, is that these central banks, which are effectively the big banks that are there for private banks to provide them with emergency money in case they need it. And in the event of a crisis, that's an emergency. That's what our Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the U.S., noted in the fall of 2008. When that happened, it provided a lot of things for the banking sector in order to enable them to continue to operate under the weight of their own bad debts and their own their toxic assets or things they had done to commit both crimes and be risk on everybody else. And so as a result, over the last 10 years, they have produced, or I use the term conjured in the book, in collusion,
right.
$4.5 trillion worth of money out of basically nothing,
you know,
electronically created money, in order to provide to the bank in return for different financial assets the bank gave them sort of in return, but at a very discounted level. In other words, it's like, you know, I give you $100 for like a stick of gum.
You'll
do that, but the stick of gum isn't really worth $100. And that's kind of what happened with what the Fed produced and conjured for the financial system. And it wasn't just the Fed. It was a global phenomenon. It was the Federal Reserve. It was a similar central bank in Japan, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank. Basically, the G7 central bank created $22 trillion worth of money to basically give to these banks, the private banks, in order for them to be able to function in supposedly an emergency situation. But of course, that's now been going on for 10 years. Now, regular people don't get that benefit. It's not like your bank account went up by even a proportional percentage of that or mine. It's just that the banks have received that, and it's where they get to get that money to pay their fines, to buy their own stock, to do a lot of other things that don't necessarily help the people they hurt or even help the overall economy.
Right. Now, you mentioned the G7. I'm looking up G7, founded in 1997, reportedly, and 62% of the global net wealth. This group of seven countries, is that really when this collusion, this problem began, or did it begin further? Who started this? I mean, basically, how and why and who? Well, we know probably why, because they're just greedy and unethical, but who and when did this start?
So basically, the G7, as you mentioned, started earlier, but the strategy of creating so much money in such a short period of time, by and large, the central banks of these G7 countries, predominantly the U.S., Japan, the U.K., to a lesser extent Canada, to the European Central Bank, which sort of covers three of the other seven countries, Germany, France, and Italy, but within one institution, they were the ones who got together at the requirement, almost the demand, of the Federal Reserve to produce all this money, because the crisis was actually much worse than people knew, and it required much more than just the central bank, just the Federal Reserve of the United States, to make the banks whole again in such a way that they wouldn't crater economies supposedly even more. So that's why there was this collusion in the last 10 years amongst the major central banks, because they had to collectively produce enough money, create enough electronic money to sustain a banking system that was pretty much interconnected. We even see that actually right now. There's a crisis in the Turkish lira in Europe, and as a result, banks in Europe, like the BNP in France, Deutsche Bank in Germany, are doing much worse, and they're having all this exposure to the lira, which in turn hurts the U.S. banks who have exposure to them. It's all codependent. So as a result, the solution, I say that with like air quotes, to fixing the crisis that the Federal Reserve concocted had to be the global solution in order not to have one market crater and then cause another market to crater while they were trying to supposedly fix everything.
Interesting. Did this begin when, you know, I've read about the gold standard and when America was on the gold standard. Did this begin when we were taken off the gold standard and that was replaced, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the gold standard was a manner in which central banks sort of agreed, and it went away in 1971, to peg, or basically to have the dollar pegged to a certain value of gold. And so the idea behind that up to that time was that the Fed couldn't go and just create dollars, just create currency, because it had this like constraint that it had to have a relationship to the gold, which was a real asset. You know, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can get it out of the ground, and so forth. And so when that went away, it didn't create the $22 trillion yet that was produced in the past decade, but it created an environment where that would be a possibility to do in the future, because by removing the gold standard or just any sort of a physical barrier or constraint,
tangible asset,
creating currency, you basically have the ability now going forward to potentially just create fiat currency, create dollars, create yen or whatever without having that that necessary constraint. And as a result of that, when the financial crisis happened 10 years ago, the central banks didn't have an implicit limit as to how much money they could create to save the system. What that meant was they didn't have to worry that they hadn't regulated it well enough to begin with, and so the crisis happened to begin with to an extent, because they could produce enough currency or produce enough electronic money to paper over any problems that were happening in the financial system, which would have been a lot harder to do had there been gold standard. But it also would have meant, I think, that they would have had to take their responsibility as regulators to the banking system. It's one of their jobs, the central banks, to regulate their own financial system and their own banking systems on a private level. They would have done that maybe with a little bit more of a sharper eye, because they wouldn't have, you know, had this more easy remedy available to them. And I say remedy in air quotes as well.
Interesting. Now, I've got two things more popped into my mind here. You've met some of these people. Presuming that's an understatement, you probably met a lot of them, I'm assuming, and worked right with them and for them. What is that like? What was that like? And are these, I mean, people are people, you know, I know there's can be good people in bad groups or bad people in a good group. You know, no group is pure per se, and no person is without, you know, fault. But, did you just get an overwhelming sense of malicious, you know, evil from these people, or you really just felt that they were kind of going along with the system that was already in place and they just really didn't do anything about it? What was your view?
You know, I think it totally depends on which individual people. Some of the people that I work with and who ran some of the private institutions, like Goldman and so forth, I think had a real disconnect with sort of the rest of humanity, sort of real empathy gene, to quote Jennifer Aniston that was missing there. But I think also that some of the people at the central banks who have the ability at the last 10 years to create all this money from positions where they effectively were not elected, they were just appointed to those positions, and they didn't have limitations, again, not just because of the gold standards we were talking about before, but there's no legal limitations how much money they can create. And so they had a power that really was bigger than the markets, almost bigger than the private banks, and a lot of them did not and still don't think about the ramifications on the negative side, like creating extra inequality or creating more debt in the world as a result of producing all this money so easily to them. of what could happen on the other side. And that's I think, a situation where a lot of them feel entitled to doing what they're doing and do it and how they do it. And some of them are just so indoctrinated with their own view of what their role, perhaps their outside role could be in terms of influencing markets or influencing the economy, that they just simply accept that as something that they own and they can use.
Interesting. What is their ultimate agenda, do you feel? Do you think that they just want to keep maintaining the status quo of how things are and just profit? Or do you think there is a more kind of covert, nefarious agenda to really just collapse global economies and rule the world?
Well, I think they are ruling the world already, and I say that because, even if we look at because of the concentration of wealth and the fact that, with the exception of real assets, replicating wealth, whether that's real estate or land or gold or whatever, a lot of financial assets that are simply market-driven, or they're on paper, or they're in accounts, whatever, tend to be accumulated in the hands of the most wealthy people who have access to be able to trade and accumulate and so forth. And the people that run the central banks, have provided them an avenue, particularly the last 10 years, to be protected in that pursuit. They protected banks that probably should have gone under because of their own nefarious behaviors and practices. They still pay fines. Take Wells Fargo as an example for continually using their own customers and stealing from them in the process.
Yeah.
These things are ongoing. You don't need them, and that's not. It's not covert. I mean, this is just what we ultimately can see. But the powers that be that could be responsible to really taking action, like the regulators that run the Fed, even like people in Congress or world leaders that connect into their central banks and produce this money and make everything therefore look better than it might otherwise be and do the real work of reforming finance to work more fairly for more people. I think, they don't tend to do that in that respect. They status quo that enables them to be at the top echelons of through the power hierarchy that influences finance and economics and the cost of money for everybody. So it is a very strong predisposition to saving the status quo, to maintaining the status quo, because that status quo is what gives them senior positions. It will give them lofty compensations. It will give them access to to travel and hang out with each other all around the world at exotic locales. In a lot of cases, not for private bankers, but with the public people involved in this and those positions, on taxpayers' dime. And it's an exciting world that they live in and that they created for themselves from that respect.
Incredible. Nomi, so much more I want to talk with you about. Please hold the line. Listeners, HollywoodSentinel.com, speaking today with legendary author, banking expert, Nomi Prinz. Go to her website, www.nomiprinz.com, nomiprinz.com. Check out her book. Pick up her book at your local independent bookseller, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rig the World. Nomi, hold the line. We'll be right back.